Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Are you supporting a loved one trapped in a system of control? Introducing Living in Freedom, a comprehensive webinar series designed specifically for family and friends like you. Part 1 provides guidance on how to support your loved one and engage in important conversations about their experiences. Part 2 offers strategies for intervening without alienating your loved one. And Part 3 equips you with the tools to find your own support and navigate this challenging journey alongside your loved one. Don't try to navigate this challenging path alone. It's so difficult when you're dealing with so much and also feeling isolated within it. Get the complete Living in Freedom series and gain the knowledge you need to help your loved one while taking care of yourself. This lecture series and more are available for purchase on my website, rachelbernsteintherapy.com. Just follow the link in the description of this episode to view and purchase all of the available lecture videos. I hope you find this really helpful to you. Take good care. Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have Brian Recker, and he has a Master of Divinity. He is a former Marine officer, the son of a Baptist preacher, and an alum of the fundamentalist Bob Jones University. Brian spent 8 years as an evangelical pastor before deconstructing his faith to find a more inclusive spirituality. He now speaks about following Jesus without fear of hell on his popular Instagram account and his Substack, Beloved. His book, Hellbent, great title, comes out September 30th, and he lives in Raleigh, North Carolina with his 4 children and a rescue pup named Maeve. We're going to give you some good contact info so you will know where to find him on his Instagram and Substack, and also where to purchase his book. Here's Brian now.
It is so nice to have Brian Recker with me today. There is so much to talk about. I would love for you to take a moment to introduce yourself and also mention some of the things that you want to make sure to cover today. And I know our conversation can go many different directions, but it's lovely to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rachel. So I'm Brian Recker. I am a former evangelical pastor. I'm sure we'll get into my story a little bit, but my story starts earlier than that. Prior to being evangelical, I was actually raised as an independent fundamental Baptist. My dad is still an independent fundamental Baptist pastor. I followed his footsteps and went to Bob Jones University, became an evangelical pastor after that, and really, I mean, through a winding series of confrontations with myself and figuring out what it looked like to live in integrity, I ultimately stepped away from that in 2020. And since then, have been figuring out deconstruction on the other side of that and have spoken a lot about my journey online. And yeah, it's kind of led to a platform in speaking about deconstruction. And I found that one of the main issues for me was the concept of hell, that binary punishment-centric storyline that we received. And taking that apart was a big part of rediscovering a healthy whole spirituality on the other side, because I found that so much of my spirituality was tied up in punishment avoidance because of some of those things. So I wrote a book called Hellbent about untangling our spirituality from fear and punishment, which comes out in September. So we could talk about that.
Yeah,
we could talk about just deconstruction in general. I try to tell people there's no predetermined outcomes. I'm still a Christian, although that word, it looks and means something a lot different for me now than it did back a few years ago. But I don't think that's the right way to deconstruct by any means. I don't try to tell people they should land and become a Christian. Even my book, I tried to write it in a way that would be approachable for you wherever you land, Christian or not.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah. Oh, there's so much to talk about, just like I thought. So, couple things. First, there's an interesting word you use that I want to come back to, which is to live in integrity. The word integrity, I hear quite often by people who are leading cults, people who are controllers, who will tell people that they have to show integrity by sticking with the plan, by sticking with the rules, by keeping up with the promise they made and with the guidelines they were supposed to follow, and that somehow is showing your integrity. And it's not at all. Integrity is something that comes from the inside. It's not just keeping with this spiritual contract you made to make sure that you follow what someone else is saying and you believe what someone else is telling you to believe. And it's one of these examples of how a word is perverted and used against people being able to truly be themselves. I find that fascinating.
Absolutely. For me, it really did mean I just had to acknowledge what was already true. Integrity, there were several years there where I was suppressing things. I was censoring myself. I was preventing myself from fully exploring certain concepts, theological ideas. For example, one of the big ones in evangelicalism is LGBT affirmation. It's kind of funny because evangelicals talk about like core doctrines, or they might call it open-handed versus closed-handed issues. In other words, the things that we'll really like die over versus like, hey, agree to disagree, like Bible translation and that sort of thing. And on the surface, you might think that LGBT issues would be quite a open-handed agree to disagree issue because it doesn't really touch any of the core doctrines. It doesn't have anything to do with the Trinity or the divinity of Christ or what happened on the cross, all those things. You could buy into really most of the fundamentalist Christian framework, and it doesn't really have anything to do with being gay, you would think. And yet, for whatever reason, really, that shows you how much of this is cultural and not scriptural, that very much is a close-handed doctrine for evangelicals, where I knew intuitively that if I were to affirm queer people, it would mean I would be out of a job, out of many relationships, out of those networks of relationships, really not just out of that specific job, but really out of that whole world wouldn't have anything to do with me. And so that was a pretty costly thing, which meant that for me, the reason I used integrity was I recognized that there was a big part of me that wanted to affirm queer people, and I wasn't letting myself go there because of what that would cost me in these other areas. And so integrity for me looked like just being honest about that, what I was already feeling and thinking, and letting those things be true and being willing to speak them out courageously and also explore them to their natural ends, regardless of what that might mean in terms of what I was a part of.
That's so powerful. I want to come back to a couple of things you said. I just am also wanting to honor the fact that it is Pride Month now as we're recording this. And yesterday there was a big news article and on the news about the name Harvey Milk being taken off a naval ship to be replaced by someone's name, I suppose, who's not gay. Trump decided that yesterday. And they timed it at the beginning of Pride Month to do that. Harvey Milk, anyone can look him up, but to find out how much of a hero he was, but also he was a naval hero. His name should be on that ship. And what I inadvertently love about, I mean, this is horrible, but what I inadvertently love about it is that now people are talking about Harvey Milk. And so the next generation of people are saying, who's this guy? I'm so happy he's going to be able to be recognized again, which I'm sure was not their plan at all. But I love when things work out, not on purpose and not for the intended purpose. It is very interesting about people being erased and people going into the shadows. And I think it's perfect to have you be able to be here, just like the other guests who come onto the show, who say, I'm not going to stay in the shadows. I'm not going to just be erased. I'm going to come forward. I'm going to write my book. I'm going to speak out for myself and for others, because it's a very important thing to do, but integral, and I think still pastoral in so many ways. What are your thoughts about that?
I know quite a few former pastors who have had deconstruction journeys, and this is not a slight on any of them, but I know some that do struggle with the idea of speaking publicly because you do still have a lot of those relationships. Those relationships don't just go away. And it does cause issues for me. When I first started posting and speaking about it publicly, my dad called me and was emotionally pleading with me, really saying, Brian, it grieves my spirit that you would post these things as your father. And he has a very, again, a fundamentalist worldview. And he even said, it says in the word of God that a false teacher is worthy of a more severe punishment. And so I'm like worried about your soul. And would you just consider taking these things off the internet? He was emotional. That was a hard conversation where I had to say, Dad, you know, I appreciate your concern. I know that this is coming from a place of love, but I'm going to have to like do what I believe to be right. I'll take what you said into consideration, but I'm going to ultimately have to follow my conscience. The reality is, this is a man who has plenty of things online. He's a pastor. His things are online that I disagree with, but I'm not telling him to take those down. So a lot of times the people that aren't speaking up, they're doing that to mollify relationships where those people are playing by different rules. They're speaking up very loudly about often potentially bigoted ideas or other kinds of ideas as if that's the default option. But when you change your mind, you're expected to center their feelings and not talk about your evolution or your changes. I'm not saying that it's everybody's job to post or to talk, have a podcast or anything like that. If you feel called to speak out and you're only doing it to not unsettle people, I think there are ways where you can communicate love to them. I try to remind people this isn't personal. Like, I'm not out to get you. I'm speaking my truth, just like I'm not going to take it personally that you say things that I disagree with. But I do find that that has been healing to me, because what I've then found is that when I speak out, I find my people too. And then you have new people who, okay, at this point, yeah, I know that I'm going to disappoint some people when I speak out, but I also know that there's other people whose opinions I value more and whose ultimately admiration I appreciate more because I align with their values. And therefore, because I align with their values, them saying something to me means more than when somebody, why am I trying to get the encouragement from people who don't have values that I even agree with? That doesn't really mean much to me. So it's like, who are we trying to impress here? I don't want to live to impress anyone. I want to be true to my conscience, but you do find people whose values you align with, and that tends to be much more encouraging when you get that feedback. And so even though it is hard to hear from people, like whether it be my parents or people that I used to be in ministry with, that they're disappointed in me. That's never an easy thing to hear, but it means a lot more to me hearing from queer people in my life, people who have gone through high control religion and are looking for hope. And when they say, man, your words and you speaking out has brought me incredible hope and made me feel encouraged in certain ways, like I grasp onto that.
It's very powerful. And I'm glad you brought up about how speaking out isn't necessarily what everyone needs to do or feels they want to do or feels ready to do. And I think really showing integrity, honesty, means being able to say, this is not something I want. That's my choice not to. People have sometimes apologized to me. Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm not ready to be on your podcast. Like somehow that's this ideal. And anything short of that, you're sort of failing. You're failing the world in some way by not doing this. But really, it's you being true to you. And whatever you feel like doing or whatever you feel ready to do. And now you have the freedom to follow that, which I think is really quite important. And it's important for me to say that that is not something that I'm holding people up to a certain standard of being out and proud about whatever it is that they've gone through. What's also important to note, and something I've talked about on the podcast before, is that sometimes people, it's not that they don't want to speak out, they just don't want to be the first voice. They don't want to be the only voice. Sometimes people think if they're the first, they also might be the only. They don't know other people are experiencing things until they hear it from someone else. So you've probably then heard people say, oh, thank goodness, I'm so glad. Now I can share.
One of the most common things that I hear, and I get a ton of DMs, and I feel like 30% of the DMs I get are, you're giving words to what I've been feeling. That's like a sigh of relief. There is something in our spirit that's just like, I'm not alone. Oh my God, thank you that there's this other person. And there's so many, it's not just me, obviously. But for some people, especially if you're in that world of evangelicalism, you're already being told not to listen to certain voices. So a lot of times I'm saying things that queer people have already been saying for 20 plus years. But if you're in evangelicalism, you're probably not following a bunch of queer content creators. You're limited on who you're even allowed to listen to. And so if I am able with my voice to speak to people who maybe aren't yet, they haven't been given permission from within to even expand that group of people, then I'm able to maybe voice some things that they're actually not hearing in their echo chambers. And so that feels really good to be able to speak that, not things that nobody's ever thought before. I want to speak what you're already thinking, and then you know you're not crazy.
Right? I mean, when you're in these environments, you have no one to talk to. So you do think that you are the outlier a lot of the time. Like, am I the only one who's having this impact or feeling scared or feeling wrong? Or it's very important to also know that in these environments, you are never the only one who is feeling that way. You just might not know it because you don't have a chance to speak with other people about it. And I want to hear more about your experience and growing up with a father who is a pastor and then becoming one, but also Bob Jones, all of that, as much as you would like to share with us about that. And then I want to make sure to talk to you about hell, which is not usually something I say to people.
Well, you don't want to talk about hell?
Right. We just might have to wait to talk about hell for a little while because I want people to hear your story. But hell is a very, very interesting subject. So tell us a little bit about your growing up years and the formative part of your life and how it impacted you.
So I was raised Independent Fundamental Baptist, which, you know, if you've seen like the Duggars, those are IFB. That's a different group. The main difference between us and them was our group, it wasn't all about like the families have to be massive. So thankfully, I have like a normal number of siblings, but there are definitely overlaps in even the way I was parented. Spanking was obviously a big deal. And the idea of obedience and discipline and authoritarian style. That being said, I do want to just say I got very lucky that both my parents are temperamentally very kind people. And so I know of other people that are in my world that had pretty adverse experiences because those people were attracted to fundamentalism because they already maybe had like a, I don't know, like a bent towards sadism or something like that. And my parents are not sadistic people. They're very sweet, sweet people that have really bad ideas is how I think about it. I don't have like a horrible childhood, but I will say that I learned about hell from before my memories even begin. I was told that you're a sinner, that you need to be saved, that unless you're saved, that you're going to die, you're going to go to hell. But if you're saved, then you could go to heaven. And so for me, spirituality, and I was in church 3 to 4 times a week with my dad as a pastor, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, and then maybe some other sort of Bible study or event that would happen. So minimum 3 times a week. And it was a pretty fire and brimstone experience where you were always being confronted with those eternal realities. And so there's a lot of fear in that. It was always like, am I good enough? Am I right enough? Am I saved enough? And so I was definitely one of those kids that was constantly praying that salvation prayer to make sure that I was safe, like a Hail Mary sort of thing. So I went to Bob Jones where my parents, they wanted me to go there. I was homeschooled throughout. So I didn't really have like a big expansive view of what my life could become. I kind of stuck with the program. But at Bob Jones, although it was very much a bubble and fundamentalist, I did meet friends. What I found was I didn't actually like the people that were all in. The people that drank the Kool-Aid of Bob Jones were quite detestable. Their version of spirituality was basically being a narc. We called them boges. That was our nickname for people that really bought into the Bob Jones ideal way of being. And the way that you knew they were boges, they would turn you in for stuff. Bob Jones is notorious for having all these rules. Girls had to wear pantyhose every day. As a guy, I had to wear a tie every day. And not only that, it had to be all the way up. If you like loosened it at half mast, you get in trouble, get demerits. You get demerits for having frays on your pants or untucking your shirt. couldn't wear jeans. There was room check where they're checking the cleanliness of your room. You get demerits all these different ways. If your hair was on your ears and that sort of thing. If you had uncheckable music, I grew up, even CCM, like Stephen Curtis Chapman or Chris Tomlin, that was considered worldly. So we only listened to like hymn type, organ type, piano type music, orchestral, nothing with a drum or an electric guitar. And so if you were caught with uncheckable music, which could literally be like contemporary Christian music, even counted as uncheckable music, you get demerits. And so a boge would turn you in. And that was considered like being a spiritual leader, was being the kind of person who took the rules really seriously. Even though I grew up in fundamentalism, I was quite repulsed by the legalism there. And so I latched on to the quote unquote more normal people, which were kind of more mainstream Christian evangelicals that ended up at Bob Jones for whatever reason. So my first step of deconstruction really was stepping away from that fundamentalism and becoming a more mainstream evangelical, recognizing that I could listen to contemporary Christian music. I could wear jeans to church. I could even maybe have an occasional beer as long as you didn't get drunk and that sort of thing. This felt very liberating to me that you could be a bit more normal. So on the one hand, I'm quite thankful that I had that relatively early deconstruction experience and grew up in fundamentalism, because once you get a muscle for self-reflecting on your worldview and taking it apart and recognizing that the people who shaped your world were wrong about some things, once you kind of get a muscle for that, I think you can keep doing that. It gives you a more expansive world. But I did get a little bit stuck, because when I came out, I was so excited about this more liberating version of Christianity, which for me was just evangelicalism at the time. I became a pastor quite quickly in my early 20s. What I discovered in becoming a pastor is that pastors are uniquely trapped because of the institutional pressure that's on them, both relationally and financially. Even though pastors might have more theological education than somebody else, they are less really likely to be objective about any particular theological idea, because so much is at stake in changing their minds. And so it's very hard to evolve once you are locked in to a position of authority in a system like that. So becoming a pastor in my young 20s, right after evolving and coming out of fundamentalism, I sometimes wonder, like, if I didn't become a pastor, how much I would have kept evolving at that time. But it almost kind of kicked the can about 10 years or so. It locked me in there, becoming a pastor.
You know, it's interesting. I'm remembering random story from when I grew up going to Jewish summer camp. And you were also not supposed to listen to secular music while you were there. But even though my dad was the president of the camp, I still brought contraband. And I'm going to sound like an 80s kid by saying this, but I brought my Oingo Boingo cassettes to listen to with my friends. And at the last day, the lost and found, the rabbi gets up and he's like, holds up everything that's been found around the camp that needs to be retrieved and taken home. And then he held up a cassette and he wasn't wearing his glasses and he's an older man anyway at that point. And he said, "Whose Dingo Bango cassette is this?" And I said, "That's my Dingo Bango cassette." So now everyone still from that day who sees me, they're like, "Hey, is Dingo Bango in concert? You want to go see it?" But this idea to give this depth that is not just about this band, but there is this idea that exposure to the world is going to ruin you and that it's going to be the slippery slope. You'll never be retrieved. And you can grow up feeling really frightened, I think, of exposure, and that it's like sliding on ice. As soon as you start doing something, you're just going to keep going. Like there's going to be nothing to grab onto to stop yourself from going into, I don't know, sin or something. And I'm wondering what that's like, what that does to you when you're growing up with that feeling and those prohibitions.
Yeah, the idea of something being worldly was like a concept that was talked about all the time, and that was a negative thing. And now, very interestingly, I think of that word very differently. Something worldly, I think of as exposure to things beyond myself, to other cultures, to other places, being able to be curious about people who do life in a different way. I think that expands our consciousness, expands our view of humanity, and makes us better people, ultimately. And so to have that narrow view, that really does come from this sense that, well, it's a binary worldview where we're right and everyone else is wrong. And actually, it's the same worldview, too, that even leads to the idea, you're hearing some people talk about toxic empathy now. Have you heard that?
Oh, that's so interesting. Talk about that.
So there's a book, Ashley Beth Stuckey, I think is her name. She just wrote a book called Toxic Empathy. There was another guy who wrote a book called The Sin of Empathy. These are coming from more conservative evangelicals. And the idea is, yeah, our empathy can be a bad thing if it causes you to compromise on the truth. And so they are, in a sense, you can see the fear there of don't even empathize too much, because when you open your heart to that and you realize, I mean, the danger is realizing, oh, maybe we're all kind of the same. Like, oh, maybe we have more in common than we have separate. And to me, that's actually the essence of good, healthy spirituality. It brings us into our oneness, our connection with one another, as opposed to separation. And so spirituality for me in fundamentalism was defined by separation rather than connectedness. And in that sense, it was the opposite of true spirituality. I call it in my book, the spirituality of hell, because it was also undergirded by this reality that we were going to heaven, everyone else was going to hell. That's a fundamentally alienating belief that does drive a lot of these other, and it provides kind of justification for viewing all these people in that different way. You don't want to be associated with those people. They're going to hell.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it's such an interesting, just to jump into this term, toxic empathy, because I don't ever imagine those words going together. I see them as opposites. I think it's toxic if you don't have empathy. That's fascinating to me. But I suppose anything, I mean, it's like toxic positivity. Like there can be things that can be problematic.
Yeah. I'm not saying that there's not an example, but I think the example that I've thought of that could be like an actual example of toxic empathy is, for instance, if you, yeah, are just constantly sacrificing parts of yourself and compromising on your own integrity in order to bend over backwards and serve someone else's needs because you empathize so deeply with those needs. Or even like a woman who stays with an abusive man because she can see like, oh, look at all he's been through. He came by it honestly. He was abused by his dad. And so that empathy for him, like he's got a good side to him, caused her to stay in an abusive situation. Like, I don't think that that's true empathy. And that's not really what they're talking about either. They're really talking about this idea of being inclusive in your relationships and in your theology. We want to shut that down. And so, yeah, within fundamentalism, I was not being encouraged to be empathetic. I was being encouraged to keep the world at a distance. And the world was something that could corrupt you. It also gives you just a fundamentally bleak worldview. You view the world as evil, which means we live in a bad place. We live in a bad universe. The universe is evil and corrupting you. So you have to stay safe. You have to stay close to what you're familiar with. You don't want to be exposed to these new things, which will make you worse. And all of that is a lie. And it actually holds you back from all the growth that we actually need.
Right. This idea that you need to stay separate, but also superior.
Yes.
Very interesting thing. And that's hard to grapple with. I think there are a lot of people who are clients of mine in private sessions or in group therapy who will talk about feeling they have a moral injury. They were made to do things that were really against their moral core, but also they were made to look at the world and others in a way that doesn't fit what they now know to be right and feel right. But it's certainly encouraged. And I think it's one of these fear mechanisms probably to keep people in, because if the whole world is corrupt or less than or lower than, you don't want to go there. And that's your only option. I think that was probably how it was presented to you, that there is just two options.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was very much us versus them. Evangelicalism and fundamentalism are different in this area. Fundamentalism is all about separation, whereas evangelicalism is more based on engagement with the world, but still for the purpose of converting the world. And so that's what evangelism is bringing the good news that will save the world. But Billy Graham was kind of the forerunner of the evangelicals. This is funny. He actually went to Bob Jones, and I think he was either kicked out or they like disowned him because they found that ministry to be too compromised, because Billy Graham he was more engaging. And so he would do things with the world in order to engage with the world. Whereas Bob Jones and the fundamentalists were very much, the world's going to corrupt you. Billy Graham had more of a forward leaning, like, well, no, we need to engage with the world. But it still was a superiority, really, because this idea of conversion is really the idea, yeah, I'm going to engage with you because you need what I've got. It's hard to have a posture of mutuality where I can really learn from you if I think that what you know is going to send you to hell and what I know is going to send me to heaven, then this isn't a relationship of mutuality. You are a mission field.
Oh, that's so fascinating. Exactly. I'm guessing that when you're in it, you don't see that. It's only when you leave and you have that perspective that you can see that things are actually quite the opposite of how they were presented.
Like I said, I left fundamentalism and became evangelical, and that at first felt very liberating because I was done with that whole idea that the world is going to corrupt me. I want to be separate from everybody. I was ready to be a bit more normal. I was ready to wear normal clothes, listen to normal music, and be more engaged. But what I wasn't ready to do was to take apart that very fundamental, baseline, foundational belief of that binary universe, that there is an us, there is a them, and my views are the correct and heaven-leading ones, and there is a hell. That was so core and fundamental to the whole way that I viewed the world. That was drilled into me from the very beginning. And if that was taken away and not true, it felt like everything was up for grabs. And it also felt like, because that was so central to my idea of Christianity, that if there was no punishment for people who weren't Christians, then what's the point of it? What's the point of spirituality? What's the point of any of it? Why does it matter what you believe? Nothing matters if there's not that you're punished, you're in, you're out type of binary. And so that was harder to take apart in some ways. And it took me some time to realize that at first it felt good just to take apart the fundamentalist separate thing, but that deeper level of binary thinking was more fundamental and took me longer to see actually that evangelicalism and fundamentalism had a lot more in common than I initially thought. And I had to just get to the point where it stopped working.
Where it stopped working. That's so interesting. So tell me about that. What does that mean that it stopped working?
So I think the scales first started to fall off of my eyes in 2015 when Trump really became kind of the front runner of the Republican candidates. Watching that happen, prior to then, I had not been very politically engaged and I was kind of a thoughtless conservative. I was raised on Rush Limbaugh, like literally playing in my kitchen every day and being told the Democrats were evil. And in my mind, yeah, being a Republican was like, that was just the only valid Jesus option. And I never really questioned that much. But watching that happen, I was repulsed by Trump, by not only his words and actions and who he was, but I began to even then see how his policies and what he believed, it really indicted the entire conservative movement. And it made me kind of see it for what it was. So I was a little bit thankful that this mask off moment, it was like, hey, this is who we've always been. He just was saying the quiet parts out loud in some ways. And I just wasn't prepared for so many people that I had previously respected and thought of as those are the good spiritual people lining up behind him and supporting him, both in my church and my family. And for me, that was the permission I needed to question everything, because I'm not sure of everything, but if there was one thing I was sure of, it was that he was a bad hombre. Like, this is a bad person. I really then also felt like if you don't have the moral discernment to see that, then I think there's something fundamentally broken about your worldview. And also, my thought was, wait, many of the people who shaped my worldview and my spirituality do not have the moral discernment to see through Donald Trump. They think this is a good leader. And then, so the next thought was, well, what else are they lying to me about? And why have I been so careless in just accepting this worldview and not really deeply interrogating it? So it kind of gave me permission to begin a whole journey of just investigation, which looked like a lot of different things all at once. Politically, I began to really go deep and say, why was I just a conservative so thoughtlessly? Became quite leftist in my views as I began to actually dig into it myself. I did a deep dive even on hell while I was still a pastor. I began preaching about more inclusive ideas and trying to encourage people. I still was a pastor from that time for the next 5 years, but I saw myself less as, I think just my positioning and the way that I viewed what I was doing began to shift, where at first I was like, I'm a part of this. We're all in this together. We all see things the same way. Whereas I began to see myself less preaching to the choir and more trying to push back on this tide of Christian nationalism and aggressive, toxic, violent, militant Christianity. They're listening to Fox News every day, and I'm able to challenge them to love their neighbors, to include their immigrant neighbors on Sunday. And so I found purpose in doing that still, but it began to stop working as I realized that I could only go so far from within that institution, and I was censoring myself in order to remain in it because I didn't want to encounter the entire cost of being fully true and fully honest. And so I could nibble at the edges, but I couldn't really be fully real with what was happening inside of me until I decided to step away.
So it's interesting you mentioned cost, and I want to come back to that thought that there are people who I have talked to who said, I was a pastor in this or a pastor in that, turned out to be more culty than anything, or turned out to have a philosophy or theology that I no longer believed in. And I suddenly realized that as I'm giving these sermons or homilies, I'm not connecting with the messages anymore. Like, it's feeling like I'm talking, but I'm talking to myself as I'm talking. Like, really? I don't know. I'm not sure. Is this right? There was like this inner chatter while words are coming out of your mouth. And I just wonder if that was part of what was happening for you.
I tried not to say things that I didn't believe, but I certainly didn't say things that I was beginning to believe. And so it was more holding back. I didn't find myself lying in the pulpit. I mean, certainly looking back, I said things that I would disagree with now. I have continued to evolve. I will say this, though, that yeah, it began to ring a little hollow to talk specifically about, yeah, salvation, believing in Jesus, letting Jesus's love change you, and then realizing that these people who thought they loved Jesus, who thought they were following Jesus, who thought Jesus's love was changing them, would then go and be in like literally a Trump boat parade the next day and vigorously support his policies. So to me, it was like, okay, I wanted to talk more about that in a more direct way. I was a multi-site pastor, which I don't know if you're familiar, but basically I led my congregation, but it was like a family of congregations. And so I was not like an independent guy doing my own thing. So there was kind of like a key leader over the different congregations as well. And we talked about this. They were familiar with where I was at and my frustrations. Thankfully, one thing that kept me there longer during that time was the leadership were not big Trump people. In fact, I would say, I don't have numbers on this, but most evangelical pastors are probably even a little bit more progressive in their congregations. Now, they're certainly very vocal, nationalistic. The ones that you'll often see, there's a lot of Trumpy pastors, no doubt. But I don't think the majority of pastors are just like waving the Trump flag. But what my lead pastor said to me was, hey, I understand where you're at. And some of that stuff bothers me too. But we've got to just keep it about Jesus. And let's just trust that like, as we keep it about Jesus, people will make those calls for themselves and that sort of thing. We don't want to be divisive. Because listen, if we just bash Trump, they'll just leave our church and go to a church that is more Trump friendly. So that was kind of his take on it. I was like, listen, that's fine for you, but I'm starting to get to the place where I'm watching this major discipleship crisis unfold, where it's not just like, hey, some people in our church are into Trump. Like, that wasn't it. No. The whole country is being influenced in a very dark direction, and evangelical Christians are leading that charge. Like, if you look at who the quote unquote bad guys are in our country, who's maybe doing the most damage, these are our people. This is our problem. And if we're not speaking about it, that's like an elephant in the room and we're just ignoring it. And then I started to feel like if that's the case, what is the point of me as a pastor, as a supposed spiritual leader, if I'm just going to be silent about this major issue as it just overwhelms our people and our institutions? And it felt like we were being negligent. I couldn't do it anymore. I was like, I've got to stop censoring myself, my own spirit. And so that was part of why I stepped away.
So to go back to the idea of cost, because I think sometimes people do stay in things for longer, I think, because they're trying to weigh the cost of leaving. And sometimes they think that that means leaving God because that's how it's been told to them, or leaving God's protection, or leaving family and leaving community. But I feel like there is a huge risk that you have to be ready and willing to take on. What was that like for you?
I mean, the cost has been tremendous. I didn't keep anything. Yeah, I lost my job, my identity as a pastor. My marriage ultimately fell apart and I got divorced. I moved to a new place. I've had to make new friends. And so in terms of the old life, I had to say goodbye to what my life was. And also not just the past of what my life was, but the future of what I pictured my life would be. So there was a security and a stability and like, oh, this is what my life is going to continue to look like. And so that was maybe even the bigger cost of stepping into the uncertainty of, I don't know where this is going. I don't know what this is going to look like. That was the scarier part. That being said, I was already paying a cost to my own self. So I was paying that cost by not being who I thought I was supposed to be. I think you can do that. You can do that for a long time. But at some point, I think most people do have a breaking point. And I think that ripping the Band-Aid off, it was ultimately, I'm glad that I paid that cost. And now I do. It, like, life's taken a few years. So this is now 5 years out from that decision to resign. And I will say my life still is not as stable, secure as maybe it felt when I was a pastor at that time. I don't live in as ordered a universe I am becoming more comfortable with what my life is. And here's what I'll say, and I felt this for years, even before I've started to kind of find some grooves like I'm in now. But even when I was paying that cost early on and I was experiencing a lot of losses, I didn't ever regret it because I always felt proud of myself more than I'd ever been. And so I was proud of who I was becoming throughout that process. And I always felt like I was taking a step that was true. And so you don't end up regretting it, but I'm not going to say it's not scary, especially if you are really deeply embedded in that institution, like a pastor or some sort of a leader, which is why we see so few key leaders, like at the top. It's very rare for somebody who's very prominent in these organizations to have a major deconstruction. There's just so much to lose at that point.
It's interesting. There is this expression, better the devil you know than the devil you don't. It's kind of perfect here also with religious teachings, but people want to know. They want to know what their life is like and who's going to be in it and what the rules are. And sometimes people are so drawn to groups that will give them the formula to follow because it feels so comforting. You can kind of just sit back and go on automatic pilot, feels right. But then people don't end up asking questions like, is this true? Is this real? Is this right? Because it feels so good to have kind of this parental feeling like now I get to be a kid again and just follow and I'll be okay. And to move out of that takes an inordinate amount of bravery, I think.
For sure. I mean, we crave comfort and stability and structure and all of that. However, what I have found, and I think this gets more and more true the older you get, we grow the most in those liminal spaces when we don't have those things. Whether it's divorce or deconstruction or moving away from a job, when those sort of organizing principles of your life, those things are great in the sense that, yeah, they calm your nervous system and they make you feel safe, but they do cause you to go on a certain autopilot that can cause you to go out of alignment with some of the things that matter most. And personal growth doesn't tend to happen when you're on autopilot. Biblically, like you see this pattern quite frequently, it's called the wilderness. Nobody wants to go to the wilderness. The wilderness is where you don't have the comforts. Those are removed from you. There's no certainty. Every spiritual figure goes through the wilderness before they have any kind of powerful ministry. Jesus was in the wilderness. Like that's always the pattern. Even the ultimate sort of Christian paradigm for spiritual growth is that death always precedes resurrection. And so we do everything in our power to avoid these deaths. And what we're ultimately doing is putting off that new life of who we're meant to become. One doesn't happen without the other. And so when we avoid the cost, we are also avoiding, I think, this spiritual resurrection that can take place. And these are mythological patterns that, I mean, almost every religion has this sort of thing. Joseph Campbell talked about it, where he talks about myths. So he says that the cave that you fear to enter holds the treasure that you seek. And so, yeah, nobody wants to let go of some of those things that are holding back the suffering. And yet I've found that the kind of growth that I've needed, especially through this season of life, was only ever going to happen if I allowed that suffering to come.
That's very powerful. I want to make sure to talk about your book and talk about the subject matter, but was there something else just about your experiences that you wanted us to know about or about leaving or about when you first came out of it and what you needed during that time?
I will just say that I quickly found friends in, I might say unexpected places, but maybe not so unexpected. The people that I'm often closest to now are queer people, which is kind of ironic because 5 or 6 years ago, I was not even affirming of queer identity. But what I have found is that community and many people are just eager to embrace you. And so I will say, like, I think sometimes people are afraid, well, these are the people that have my back. And if I become more true and start speaking out in certain ways, then nobody's got my back. I think there will be people that are eager to be forgiving and to have your back. Very quickly, I made really close friends with a couple of married gay dads that lived in our neighborhood. And as I went through my divorce, they invited me on their family vacation. They like surrounded me with love. And just a few years before, they knew that I was an evangelical pastor who had in my statement of faith, being homosexual is a sin. They knew that about me, but they also knew like we're all on a journey. And so those communities do tend to be very welcoming as well. And so I have experienced the embrace of people. That's been very healing for me.
That's so lovely that you were invited on their family vacations. That is so important when people reach out when people are neighborly, when people are kind, when people remember how important community is, and not just talking the talk, but walking the walk and making the invitations and really being inclusive and lovely. It's really an important message. I have this other question about self-talk, because I hear about this a lot with people who are coming out of situations where they might be able to connect with some people who are former followers or former members of whatever it is, but they find they're still battling their self-talk, the things that they learned, the messaging that they learned that was defamatory, that was critical, that was fear-based. And so I'm wondering, if you don't mind, I know that gets sort of personal and into your head, but to share maybe if that's something you had to grapple with.
Yeah, actually, one of the more common questions I get from people is like, okay, I'm deconstructing. You talk about how you don't believe hell is like a real place. And they're like, hey, I want to believe that too. As I'm processing that, I'm just haunted by this feeling of, well, what if I'm wrong? These other voices, we're still haunted by those things. And I don't think there's like a quick fix for that, especially if you've been indoctrinated to believe a certain way your whole life. I think to first of all, know that those voices, that's not like the Holy Spirit. That is the fact that you've been indoctrinated since you were a child to believe that. But for me, the work of Byron Katie has been pretty helpful for me. She talks about interrogating our thoughts. And the idea is that a belief is just a thought that you keep having over and over again. And so these beliefs that we agreed with, when a belief is handed to you and you agreed with it at a young age, okay, yeah, I'll buy that. There's a hell. Like I agreed with that belief. And you agreed with that belief for decades. And then to just break up with it, it's left some grooves there. And so give yourself grace that that's going to take some time. But as that thought comes, I just think a better thought. You can turn that thought around. You interrogate that thought by saying, okay, I'm feeling like, okay, am I going to hell? Is that true? Well, I don't know. I was told it was true my whole life. Do I absolutely know that it's true? That's her second question. It's like, well, I guess I don't absolutely know. Nobody really knows. And then her third question is, how does it feel? What happens in my body when I believe that thought? And so it's like, well, yeah, when I believe that I'm going to hell, that doesn't feel good. That's a bad fear-based thought. And then who or what would I be without that thought? And that's the way she interrogates these beliefs. And it's like, yeah, I think I would live more free. I think I could be more myself. I wouldn't be as controlled by this fear of punishment. And then you think, well, what's a better thought? How can I turn that thought around? And you just have to do the work, really, of replacing these old beliefs and old thoughts, better beliefs that lead you into a better way of living, where you're a more loving, whole, actualized person.
It's really important. And I wish more people took the time or had the courage, I suppose, to interrogate their own thoughts. I think so often we see that people who are the harshest with others see something in themselves in that person that they don't like, that they are trying to reject, or they're trying to distance themselves from, and they wind up being cruel because of it. And if they took that moment and thought, what is this about? I think it would save a lot of those tortured relationships and feelings. And I don't know if that was your experience with some of the people around you who were battling inner parts of themselves, but they were doing it with other people and not being kind to noticing those traits in others.
Yeah, I try not to assume the worst about people in general, but it does seem like certainly the people who are most vehement in their attacking somebody who's deconstructing, for instance, when you're not just able to say, hey, you know, I disagree with you, but you're on your journey and good luck to you, you see that as like an attack on your own life and identity, then there's probably a lot of projection going on there. That has happened to me. Unfortunately, several people that were my friends, I don't get personal. And when I talk, you know, I am public about my changing beliefs, but I'm not saying, and this asshole lied to me about this, and this other person said this, and I hate him for that. Like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm literally just talking about things I used to believe, things I believe now. But a lot of people have taken that personally. I'm describing my personal journey. So if you take that personally, that I can't change or that reflects badly on you, that actually is a you problem. That is something that you're dealing with.
I love that expression. That's a you problem. It really comes to me handy. Okay. Hell Bent. Tell me about the book. And in the news, there have been some bishops and others who are saying hell is this construct and maybe it's not real. And I'm sure that didn't go over well. But it's something that people are really trying to grapple with, I think, in a more public way now, which is really important. So tell me about the book and how you thought of it and the subject matter.
I thought that I need to write this book. So this has always been a big issue for me. And I grew up where hell was always center stage in fundamentalism. Week to week, this was fire and brimstone. One of the things I loved about transitioning to evangelicalism is they didn't talk about hell very much at all. They put hell behind the curtain. And so most evangelical churches, you're not getting fire and brimstone, people are going to hell sermons. They are talking about Jesus. They're talking about how Jesus saves us. But like, saves us from what? It's behind the curtain. It's a little bit more hidden. And that felt good for a while. I was like, oh, this is better. I'm glad that we're not always being bashed with hell. But what I began to realize, it's the same exact story. They're just being more gentle in talking about it. You would ultimately hear it even in an evangelical church. For instance, if you went to church camp, or they do it a lot with the kids in VBS, where they're trying to get them saved and make that conversion decision, hell is almost always a part of that decision to become a Christian. A few weeks ago, I did a workshop with folks, and I just said, okay, if you ever got saved or became born again, stand up. And everybody stood up. And then I was like, okay, if hell was a part of that decision, if hell was explained to you as a part of the decision that you made to become saved or born again, remain standing. And everyone remained standing. And then I said, okay, if that happened before you were 10, remain standing. And like one person sat down. So this happened when we were very young. We made these very big spiritual decisions based on this choice. Do you want to love and serve God and go to heaven? Or do you want to reject this free offer of salvation in Jesus Christ and go to hell? And it wasn't really much of a choice at all. But it formed our spirituality. And so the reason I wrote this book was when I began to deconstruct that myself, and I pulled that thread of hell because I didn't really believe in it anymore. And even in researching as a pastor, going deep into the Bible doesn't really teach the evangelical view of hell. It is quite a construction. I go into that a little bit in the book. We don't have to go into that now. But as I began to pull that thread, though, it's like, okay, but then if no hell, then what's the point of this? Because I learned a spirituality that was so hell-centric. It really formed my very view of what it meant to be a Christian, was to be the kind of person who was going to go to heaven when he died and not hell. And so I had to learn a salvation, what it meant to follow Jesus, that was more about this life than the next life, where the whole point of it was not to believe the right things to go to the right place, where the point was love and transformation in this life for the sake of my own soul and the world and this world that we live in right now. And that was a pretty monumental shift. And I realized most people really have a hard time with that one. And that's why many people deconstructing don't stay Christian at all, which again is fine. I'm not trying to keep people Christian who don't want to be Christian. But what I don't want is for someone to think that there's no way to stay Christian if I want to reject some of those exclusionary ideas. Because actually, there have always been more universalist-minded Christians. They've tended to be a minority, but that is certainly a possibility. If you want to retain your Christian spirituality, I wanted to create some space for that. But whenever I talk about hell online, the question that I almost always get from people is, well, if there's no hell, then what's the point of Jesus? Why did Jesus die? What did he die to save us from? What are we saved from if there's no hell? And so I realized that for people, it's more than just, well, here's what the Bible actually says about hell. We have to fundamentally rethink the Christian story and why any of this could matter. And so that's kind of what I do in the book. It's not just what the Bible says about hell. It's about how Christian spirituality can be about more than punishment avoidance, how it can be about connection and love in this life for the sake of our own souls. As I wrote it too, I began to see how hell had really fundamentally distorted my spirituality. My first view of God was that if I didn't believe the right things about God, God was going to punish me in hell. And so my view of God was very much a big punishing guy. And my view of myself was that I was somebody who deserved hell. And my view of other people was that unless they believed the right things, they deserved hell. So my view of myself, God, and others was all shaped by punishment. And this caused alienation at every level, alienation in my spiritual life with God, alienation in my own heart, inability to listen to myself. I was told that my heart was deceitfully wicked. My dad told me that the messages in Disney movies like Follow Your Heart were unhelpful messages. You shouldn't follow your heart. That'll lead you astray. So I couldn't trust myself because myself, my heart was going to lead me to hell. I couldn't really feel close to God because God was ultimately a punisher. And other people had to be mission fields, had to be projects, not real friends. We talked about this. You can't enter into a relationship of mutuality with someone who's fundamentally damned. In the first part of the book, I kind of just name what happened to us in this framework and how it actually twisted spirituality to something that was very much unlike what I believe true spirituality is. I think the heart of spirituality is connection. Connection with my true self. Connection to God. Connection to others. Finding out our commonalities, not our differences. But hell really drove that wedge at every level of our spiritual lives. And so that's what I do in the book. I show how that wedge was created in our spirituality, and then I try to take it out.
How interesting. Right. I wonder also about this idea of this external locus of control versus internal locus of control, that some people have said, listen, you know, I don't know if I'm a believer or if I'm agnostic, if I'm atheist, I'm sort of in between. But when I tell people I'm atheist or even agnostic, they'll say, well, how will you know not to kill someone? And it seems like a stretch, right?
No, it's very common. I hear that all the time from people. Yeah.
Because it's wrong. I don't know how else to tell you.
Right.
Yeah, but who has decided that it's wrong? I have. I don't feel comfortable doing that. I wouldn't want someone to do that to me. I don't know if I need a God to let me know that. I wouldn't want to cause someone harm or pain. Wouldn't feel right. But then there's this notion, I think, as we go from being, this is not to say this in an insulting way, that is not at all my intention. But when we look at development and ethical development, we have oftentimes children at a very young age who will notice someone crying, will go over to see if they're okay. But still, there is this need to teach kids the rules. They'll sometimes see what they can get away with. I mean, a lot of parents will accuse kids of, this kid was testing me, but I don't think they're testing the parent. I think they're testing themselves to see what they can do and what they can get away with in the world and what freedom they have and capabilities. But as you get older, what you hope is that then there's a shift to where you don't need rules. You don't need someone narking on you. You don't need police following you to not do something dangerous or illegal. You have this guide inside that is going to let you know basically what's okay and what's not okay, and doesn't matter who's watching or not, or even what the rules are. And in fact, there is this idea that it's sometimes more ethical to not follow the laws, depending on what the laws are, because there's this example given within Jewish thought that the people who were hiding Anne Frank were breaking the law, but the people who grabbed her and took her to a concentration camp were following the law.
All of our greatest spiritual leaders were punished in some way, typically, by those controlling authorities. I mean, Jesus was executed by the state. And Martin Luther King died for a reason. So you have to be willing to almost break the rules at some point, because we don't live in a perfectly just society.
Right? So what guides you? I mean, this idea of heaven and hell, I feel like it keeps there being this external locus of control. Like, well, I don't want to do this bad thing because I'm going to go to hell, but I have to make sure to do the right thing because I want to go to heaven.
God's the ultimate cop in that scenario.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's punishment avoidance. For me, it is a shift of the foundation of your spirituality, not being punishment avoidance, but being belovedness in God. And I don't think you need the concept of God to get here. I'm not saying that necessarily, but I do see this within the Christian tradition. I believe that every single person is infinitely valuable and worthy of love. And I can derive that from the Christian tradition, the doctrine of the image of God, that every person is made in God's image, that you are a divine creation and that you are fully beloved by God. That's the foundation. And so I don't need God to punish me to treat you right. I should treat you right because you are God's beloved. And even myself, I live out of my belovedness in God as opposed to this threat of punishment. It does seem like when I talk, for instance, whenever anybody says, well, why unless punishment? It's almost like you just need to make a total mental shift in your mind. Like, because you don't apply that, surely, I hope not, to all personal relationships. Like, you're only going to do good in these various areas unless you're going to be punished. That's a horrible way to think. Why do we do that to God?
Exactly, yeah.
It makes a small, petty God, a God who is bound to punish even, who can't even break God's own rules to love. Like, nope, sorry, my hands are tied. I got to punish. I'd love to love you, but unfortunately, you broke the rules. I got to zap you. This is not a God worth worshiping. And so hell creates quite an ugly universe. It really does justify. We were talking earlier about that whole fundamentalist mindset, that whole us versus them, all that binary thinking, which has fueled some of the worst atrocities. I point out in the book that this mindset that we've got the right answers that are leading to heaven and they have the wrong answers that are leading to hell, you can justify just about anything if you believe that. And they did. Colonialism, the doctrine of discovery, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but that was the doctrine the church came up with to justify the colonial project. And it was explicitly based in the idea of evangelism that, listen, there are parts of the world, they've never heard the gospel. These people are dying and going to hell. We are the Christians. So colonization is actually a good thing. Will it involve some rape, murder, genocide, pillaging, and that sort of thing? Probably so. But hey, listen, right now they're dying and going to hell anyway. So even slavery, when African people were kidnapped from their country, the enslavers were able to tell them they were actually doing a good thing because, yeah, did a bunch die in the boats on the Middle Passage? Sure, but we're giving them the gospel. So they were going to die anyway and go to hell. At least now when they die, they have the opportunity to go to heaven. And so that kind of us versus them thinking is, I mean, it's been one of the most destructive forces historically in the whole world. So much evil has been done in the name of Christianity and justified because of hell.
Incredible. Incredible. So here we have this idea of hell. And I wonder, with the images, there are a lot of people, when I talk to people who grew up Jehovah's Witness, they have so many of these tracts with the images that they were given almost as bedtime stories. Like, here are the fires of hell. Good night.
That's my story.
So what do you do with all of that in your head and the nightmares that you might have and just processing all of that? Because it is frightening.
I'll tell you what I've done with it. And so Chick Tracks were what I was raised on. I don't know, some of your listeners might be familiar with Jack Chick was an artist who did these horrifying gospel tracks with really graphic illustrations of people just burning and worms and all of it, the works. The God figure was on a throne, big glowing face, white on a throne guy pointing away from him. You're damned, go to hell, basically. Really horrifying stuff. Yeah, some of that stuff is quite visceral for me. What I do with the doctrine of hell, I believe in hell. I just believe it's a metaphor. I believe it's a powerful metaphor. Because the reality is, when we think of those gruesome images, it doesn't take us much to know that that actually does reflect reality for many people, psychologically and materially. I mean, right now, there are horrific conditions in parts of the world that we're creating in many ways, that American bombs are contributing to. There are children being starved right now in Gaza. Hell is on earth. And really, the metaphor of hell in the Bible, you have prophetic witnesses in the Old Testament, especially Jeremiah, Isaiah, using very apocalyptic language, the day of the Lord, the valley of slaughter, these big, scary sounding things. But what are they talking about? They're talking about real world events, cataclysmic events, mass death, violence, genocide. These things are hell and these things are real. And I think it can be helpful to use spiritual language to talk about these things. I mean, Martin Luther King, better than anybody, knew the power of spiritual language to talk about social change because hellish conditions are a reality, but that's not God's hope for us. The problem is we import that spiritual language and make it about being right about all of our dogmas, about where we go in the afterlife, as opposed to seeing the whole point of spirituality is how we love now, how we live now, the hells we're creating right now. And so when I think back to the way that I thought, when I believed that I was right, everybody else was wrong. Oh, don't corrupt me. Don't let the world in. Keep the world out. That was hell. I was in a small, isolated, psychological hell, thinking hell of superiority and separation. So that's a psychological way of talking about it. I think there's material ways of talking about the ways that we create hell for the poor, for queer people who are being denied their right to exist in society. And so I think spiritual language and spiritual metaphors can still be powerful. And even the gruesome images can remind me of how horrible it is to be trapped in lovelessness, in separation, in superiority. But the point is not punishment. The point is never punishment. God is not out to punish you. That's never a helpful image. It doesn't do any good to anybody.
No, it really doesn't. It's interesting you mentioned queer people all over the world and how unsafe it is. And I think about people in Sudan. I think about all the places that are not being covered in the news. Again, talking about living in the shadows. Also, all the women who now need to cover their faces and their bodies or else and can't talk to each other and can't leave the house. Their lives are erased, basically. It's horrific. I actually got an email last week from someone who listened to the podcast who said, I vehemently disagree with your position on people who are transgender. I don't have a position. People are transgender. I don't know if that's a position. So, okay. But she was saying it's a choice and that they're choosing something that is going to be hard for society, and it's selfish to make that choice. It may, well, I don't know, all these things. And that people in her family, she reminds them of this daily. And I'm thinking, that's hell, right?
Wow.
Like, just have someone who feels the need to tell you that you are fundamentally selfish for how you are, and that you want rights, or you want to be seen for who you are. Yes, there are a lot of attitudes that bring hell into people's lives too, which is such a shame. But that's interesting. Hell is a metaphor. I really like that a lot, that it's not a place. It's something that exists within us and sometimes in our world.
Yeah, I mean, so many of the spiritual realities, they are metaphors. And I think metaphors are powerful. That doesn't diminish them at all. I mean, I think our worlds are created by metaphors. Our worlds are created by ideas and how we view these concepts. And the Bible does that. I mean, over and over again, there's images and apocalyptic images that are used to just heighten the stakes of reality, not the afterlife, of reality. And so when I'm like confronted with a fear of like, oh man, what if hell? I don't have to what if. Hell is happening. Like, I don't have to be like, oh, what if there's something to be scared of? There is something to be scared of. There are those horrors in the world. That's not something waiting on the other side of death for me if I don't believe the right thing. And so that calls me to get to work, to be a helper, to be somebody who's actually building what Jesus called the kingdom of God, what Martin Luther King called the beloved community, what you might just call putting love out into the world and trying to not create hell for people.
That should be easy, right? Not create hell for people. Like, just don't. Just don't do it. Right? Exactly. Just stop. You're thinking about saying that? Don't. Stop. Stop it. That should be easy.
There is something in us, I think, that does find security, stability in separation and superiority, or we wouldn't do it so constantly. And that, I think, is the source of where we create so much of that hell, is that need to find our salvation, not in our solidarity, not finding salvation in my connection with others, but to find my salvation in being better than, separate from, elevated from. So I'm secure, but I have to have damned somebody in order for me to be saved. And once we start to do that, that's one of the methods to feel safe, is like, well, if they're bad, then I can feel good. But that's, I think, where our trouble really comes from.
Yes, yes. Any of that, the dichotomous thinking, the black and white thinking in that way, I think is really problematic, but especially that. It's been wonderful to speak with you. I want to offer you, if there's anything else that you wanted to say, any other messages you wanted to offer, and then to let people know where to find you and where to find your book and anything else they can access.
So because I know, like I said, there's no right way to deconstruct. Many people coming out of cults, the safest thing to do might be to just leave all the God language behind because you found that it hurt you. I guess I just don't want anyone to feel like you have to hold on to the spiritual metaphors. If you find them unhelpful and they're triggering and they're traumatizing, then you can let them go. But I guess what I would also say is that God is for everybody. That is not a concept that's owned by any one religious group. I do believe, however you want to talk about it, like, God is a mystery. And so even if you don't believe in God, you probably believe there's something special about being alive. There's something special about being a person. There's something about a relationship, about love that's real and enduring. And I just think that that is for us. And nobody can rob you of that. That's our birthright, to be spiritual, to be fully connected people. And I still see a lot of that in Jesus that I can hold on to. The reason I'm still a Christian is because, despite the fact that so much of what I believe doesn't work for me anymore, when I look at it, it's like, that wasn't really on Jesus. So that was the churches, the institutions, a lot of the theology that came centuries later. But Jesus himself was still a spiritual leader, a figure that I find worth following. If that's your past, if your background was within Christianity, I just want you to know that while you don't have to hold on to anything, because you're not going to be punished for believing a certain set of things, you also have permission to hold on to whatever you want. And they don't have a monopoly on Jesus or God. And nobody can say, like, this is the one right way to think about God. And I think if you had a punishing view of God, knowing that at the end of it all, whatever happens, there's not a God test and your beliefs are going to be audited. And if you got to get all the right answers or else you're screwed in some way, that's not it. So don't even worry about rightness or correctness, because that was never the point anyway. The point is relationship and connection and love. And so rather than asking, am I believing the right thing? I've found that it's really helpful to switch that and ask, am I believing the loving thing? Who knows what's right? And love is even a little bit subjective, but at least then I have a guidepost. And so I'll just constantly return myself. And I don't think if we're constantly asking myself, am I doing what's in the spirit of love? I don't think at the end of it all, God's going to say, you know, you tried your best to be loving, but you believed a few wrong dogmas. And so I'm going to have to send you over there. So I don't know if that's encouraging, but those are some ways.
Oh, it's very encouraging. It actually targets something directly that I hear a lot, which is people who have left systems where there were like physical narcs, but also spiritual narcs, like someone's watching. There is this sense that there is someone following you with a clipboard, keeping track, and God is watching everything and knows everything and is keeping score. And you're going to fail or you're going to succeed, but that it's just this constant accruing of points or subtraction of points. And are you safe? Are you not? Are you winning? Are you losing? You're saying, just be in your life. Just be feeling. Just be connecting. Just be appreciating and not worrying about all of that.
Absolutely.
It's really good. Okay. Where can people find you, find your book, etc.?
I'm a big poster. I'm on Instagram a lot. So you can find me on Instagram at B.E. Recker is my Instagram. I also write on Substack. So you can find my Substack if you look up Brian Recker. I write meditations on the life of Jesus from just a non-dogmatic perspective. And so I'm looking again at the spirituality of Jesus and I'm finding so much of it so beautiful and important for today, especially when you separate it from that punishment framework that many of us were handed. And my book can be pre-ordered. It comes out September 30th. So I'm not exactly sure when this post will drop, but it'll probably still be available for pre-order. And if it's after September 30th, then you can pick it up directly. But pre-orders are really important for first-time authors who are trying to get their message out. But it's on ebook, Audible, and hardcover.
Wow, that's so exciting. Okay, so September 30th, 2025. Awesome. So good. I'm so excited for it to come out. Can't wait to see it. It was really wonderful to talk to you and to meet you. And thank you for what you're doing and the information you're getting out there and being a presence online for people. It's really important.
Thanks, Rachel. This has been a really fun conversation.
One more thing before you go. Thank you to Brian and to all that he shared with us about his work and about himself. It is very powerful to hear his story and where he's come to, the journey that he's taken, the bravery that it's taken, how much work he's done. I mean, it really is a lot and it really is impressive. I can't wait for you to read his book. Let us know what you think. There is something very important about the idea also that he brings up about integrity. Oh, I hear that so often. So often people are held up to this standard of needing to have integrity, needing to adhere to the teachings of a particular group and keep with your commitments to it and keep to the promises that you've made to be involved or be involved for life and believe in the teachings for life. But there is something that happens when people are held up to that gold standard of integrity, where they sometimes notice that the people in charge of the organization are not necessarily. They don't necessarily follow by the same sense of duty, of honor, of integrity. A lot of them work to just get away with what they want to get away with, but are also very happy having the other people who are following them have to uphold this standard that once they make a commitment to something, they never turn back. But when we talk about making a commitment to something, you have to be clear about what the something is. And if you're making a commitment to something, to have integrity, to be an adherent of something, if it suddenly changes on you, well, I don't think you actually have to stick with it because you made a commitment to be a follower of something that it either used to be or that it was promised to be or that, based on what you were taught, you thought it was. And now you have more information. And just like any good social scientist or any kind of scientist, what you take on as factual information is the information you have where you're incorporating all the new information along with it.
suddenly it can feel like a very different organization. Suddenly the leader doesn't potentially seem so trustworthy. Suddenly the teachings no longer feel like they're safe to follow. Suddenly the things you were told you were still going to be able to do that now you are told you're not able to do, like spend time with your family or feel good about yourself, then I think you get to then make a decision. Do you still want to follow this? Do you still need to? Because the this has changed. Or it was always that. It just is suddenly over time revealing its true self. So I think about integrity in a different way. I feel like there's personal integrity, right? That I think when we are talking to Brian, he's talking a lot about actually personal integrity. It means being true to you. So your environment can change. The people in it can reveal themselves in an alarming way. And if you go to leave and they say, ah, not so fast, you made a commitment for life. Well, the truth is, your commitment needs to be to yourself first. That's a very hard lesson for people who are in religious environments. That's a very hard lesson for people who are born in certain countries where the self is less important than the whole, than the community, than society, and what the societal needs are. It's also in religious communities seen as selfish, seen as evil, seen as the devil incarnate. And part of the reason that it's seen that way is because with most things in religious communities, when it's called those things, it's because it threatens the community. Not because that's a true assessment of you having personal integrity. It just means that if you're going to uphold personal integrity, it might fly in the face of and be in contradiction to the commitment they want you to keep making to this organization because they need you, they want you, they want to not lose members, or the leader needs that kind of adoration from as many people as possible, but that's not your responsibility. That's not something you have to keep doing just because someone else needs you to. You need you to look at what is best for you and not, again, in a dangerous way to other people, not in a selfish way, but just in a way where you can say, my self-preservation matters. And that includes checking in with myself and seeing what's right, seeing also if the life that I'm living is making me feel like I'm slowly dying. That's a time to reflect. That's a time to notice. And that if the people around you will just keep pushing you to be in that situation where you're slowly dying, they're also saying, without saying it, they don't actually care about you. So I want you to care about you. That sometimes is going to be unpopular when you're in certain environments and when you're in certain relationships. And I know it's not easy, but it's so incredibly important. And I'm glad that Brian was able to push through so much to get to where he is now, to live his authentic life, and to be able to be happy, and to be able to be him. Thank you again to Brian for coming on the show. So good to have him on. I'm glad you got to hear him. And I will talk to you next week. Take good care.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Get your exterior painting to-dos done easily with Dutch Boy Pristine Exterior Paint. With its rain rinse technology, rain naturally washes away dirt and grime. Plus, it resists cracking and peeling, making it perfect to withstand the harshest weather conditions. Save big money on pristine exterior paint and start your painting project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.